What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast brought to you by Kraken. I'm your host Peter McCormack, and today I have the second interview in my Mt. Gox series, an exclusive interview with Mark Karpeles, who was the CEO of Mt. Gox when it collapsed. But before that, I have a message from my show sponsors. If you're interested in a crypto-backed loan, well, BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender, servicing customers worldwide, including 47 US states, and their interest rates start as low as 4.5%. Also, BlockFi accepts Bitcoin, Ether, or Litecoin as collateral. Customers can be funded in USD or GUSD, which is Gemini's dollar-backed stablecoin, and you can go from application to funding in as little as 30 minutes. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans under $10,000 or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000. And applying takes less than 2 minutes. That is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, which is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid. And also, let's talk about my new sponsor, Kraken. I announced this yesterday, and thank you for all the amazing feedback on this. It seems like everyone agrees that this is a really great match. I'm really proud to be working with Kraken. And it's kind of good timing, because so much has happened for them recently. So I'm planning on telling about all these announcements they've had over the coming days and weeks. But if you haven't heard, firstly, they acquired Crypto Facilities, a world-leading regulated cryptocurrency trading platform and index provider. They also launched a beautiful rebrand of their website, including a new logo. And on January 30th, they launched their WebSockets public API for market data. And they've got so much more coming. So make sure you check out Kraken at kraken.com, the best place to buy, sell, and trade digital currencies. That is kraken.com, which is kraken.com. So on to my interview with Mark, and there are a couple of things I want to talk about here first. So this started nearly a year ago when I reached out to Mark during his Reddit AMA, which I've added a link to in the show notes, and he responded. But after that, there was kind of radio silence and nothing really happened. And then following my interview with Jed, I reached out to him, and the timing seemed to be right, as everything that was happening with CoinLab and Brock kind of made Mark want to come out and talk a bit more about what was happening. And there are certain interviews that I always want to do in person, just for a variety of reasons. And this is one of them. And I also wanted to film it. So I need to just say a big thank you to Kraken and Cash App for sponsoring this and encouraging me to go out to Japan to do this. So a funny thing when you announce an upcoming interview, if it's with a controversial person, is that you get a variety of opinions shared with you and questions people want you to ask. And with Mark, it was no different. And these opinions that have been coming through, they vary a lot. Some are really angry with him, and some people are very forgiving and compassionate. I have to try and do my best to not let that influence. I have to try my best to do my interview based on what I've read, my research, and my questions. Some people definitely wanted me to aggressively go for Mark, but I don't have a history of being a Mt. Gox customer. I'm not a creditor. I've got no anger towards him, and it just isn't really my style. Still, I hope you enjoy the interview. My thoughts will be shared in the outro. And if you have any questions about the interview, do feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And based on my previous interviews with controversial people, I'll expect there'll be a variety of responses to this. And also, if you want to support the show, there's a section on my website that explains everything you can do. If you head over to whatbitcoindid.com and click on the support section, that will explain all the different ways you can help. And I also want to thank my Patreon top tier sponsor, vidyen.com, who create open source plugins which you can use to reward users with virtual items or store credit when they mine crypto in their browser or on your WordPress site. That is vidyen.com, which is vidyen.com. Okay, I hope you enjoy the interview. As I said, if you've got any questions, you can reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Hey. Hi, Peter. I'm doing fine, you?
Yeah, I'm very good. Thank you for agreeing to do this. It was, I think, about 11 months ago when I first messaged you on the Reddit AMA. And then I've sent a bunch of emails since.
Yes.
It's been radio silence.
Quite possible. I'm sorry. Yeah.
It's okay. So why now? Why are you happy to do this now?
Well, I guess the main reason is because I had to reply to a message specifically on public media.
Right. Okay.
Considering the situation of the Mt. Gox bankruptcy, there are two things I need to make sure are known.
Which are?
One is about Brock Pierce and his claims on the, well, what he's trying to do with Mt. Gox, which I'm not sure of. And the second thing I'm trying to get known about is the CoinLab claim.
Okay. While we're here, there's a lot to go through.
Yes.
And there's a lot of the story I don't know because I came into Bitcoin really whilst it was around 2013-14. I kind of left and I've missed the whole Mt. Gox thing. But obviously, coming back in 2016, it's still a shadow that hangs over Bitcoin. So there's a lot I want to know about. So whilst I've got you, we'll go into detail. We'll find out as much as we can. So can we start, firstly, though, can you just try and give me and anyone who would be listening to this or watching this some kind of idea of what the last 5 years have been like?
Well, I guess you mean for me.
Yeah, sure.
So, yeah, the last 5 years for me have been actually quite busy. So I guess we're starting with the Mongox bankruptcy, which actually happened on February 28th of 2014. And from there, it's been a long year trying to set up things with the trustee, getting the Japanese police on the case and so on, which actually on January 1st of 2015, the Japanese police announced that they thought it was fully an inside job. And they would move 8 months later on August 1st, 2015 to arrest me. However, in the meantime, the US police has been working on the case too. More specifically, the IRS, I believe, was the main entity on working on this. And so I was arrested. I spent 11 months and a half in detention. So during that time, I was unable to get any contact with the outside. So I followed a little bit of the news of what happened, but there's nothing very major happening to me in the meantime. However, when I was out, it was July 14th of 2016. So July 14th, actually, the French National Day, which was a very good day for me because I left the detention center just for the same day terrorist attack to happen in France, which made it not so good day after all. And from there, well, things continue to move with this process in Japan. The trial start date wasn't set until much, much later, and I believe the trial started on July 11th of 2016. So I did my first trial day, and a few weeks later, Alexander Vinik, a Russian national, was arrested in Greece. So actually on my first day of trial, I pled non-guilty and I explained that I would continue working on trying to find the red culprit. And we were stole bitcoins from Mongox. So actually I believe the arrest of Alexander Vinik is a very big step in that direction. While I was arrested, the Mongox bankruptcy just continued as it would. So, well, creator files their claims, and everything seems more or less normal. The trial continued. We go in 2017, the price of Bitcoin starts to rise quite a bit, and we hit the issue with the Mongox bankruptcy, now having more assets value than liabilities. And by the time we enter 2018, I believe, things look, well, not so good. There's a lot of news coverage on how whoever owns Mongox would get $1 billion or whatever. I did try to see what I could do to solve this myself too, but it proved to be rather difficult. However, it was solved in June 2018 when creators filed for civil rehabilitation. With civil rehabilitation, actually claims are being reevaluated. Depending on what kind of plans will be approved, should be paid as whatever value people were owed, which means we basically solve this issue that came up with bankruptcy. So now the process is in civil rehabilitation. Creators are due to be paid more than they initially supposed to within bankruptcy. There's no story anymore of any kind of surplus or anything. And I believe the bankruptcy is actually on very good track to end either this year or next year, depending on how things go with, well, CoinLab, depending on how things go overall. So that's for the bankruptcy. And for the IRS, actually, I'm due for a verdict 1 month from now.
But that's, you've told the story there, but yeah. I think I want to know a bit more about what's it been like for you, because you've had to deal with the pressure of the world's biggest heist happened under your watch. You've had death threats.
You've had all kinds of accusations of all kinds of crimes. You've had anger towards you. You've spent 11 months in detention, pretty much in solitary confinement to a cell, confinement to a cell, without the ability to go outside. I'm trying to get a feeling of what it's actually been like for you and how it has impacted you.
Well, actually, for me personally, the time around the bankruptcy was probably the most stressful part. Before the bankruptcy, we didn't even know exactly what was going to happen. When Mungox went to the court to file, it was, we basically expanded all our options. We even tried to approach different VCs on the Bitcoin world to try to see if we could save the exchange. The conclusion is it was not going to be possible. So at the time, there were quite a lot of pressure. The press was sitting in front of the office for the previous few weeks. A couple of our customers were sitting there too, actually. I even had people not come to the office anymore because I feared for their lives. So basically, we filed for the civil registration at first. The press conference I gave this day, which you can probably still find a lot of examples of, was very stressful. I mean, I did try to bow and say that I'm sorry in Japanese at the same time and completely missed my words. So I did again after, but basically, it was my first time doing a press conference around Mongox, and it was to announce Mongox civil reputation and announcing that Bitcoin was stolen. So that was not very much of a good experience. In the following months, of course, I did receive a lot of death threats, a lot of angry messages from many people. I lost basically any ounce of credibility I had while running Mongox, or even just as any kind of individual. Yet, aside from Mongox, there was still Mongox parent company, Tiban, which was not bankrupt yet at the time, which I tried to keep alive, since we did have customers and things going on. They did more or less for a few months. Actually, the next year, Tiban, Mongox filed for Tiban bankruptcy. So I did my best to try to keep employees with a job. So yeah, that was quite a lot of stress too, dealing with the bankruptcy, with this at the same time. And after that, well, I didn't really know what to do with myself anymore, mostly because Mongox had kept me very busy. I would spend more than 8 hours a day in different kind of meetings with banks, lawyers, and, well, all sorts of people. So when Mongox and Tiban were both in bankruptcy, I tried to find something new to start, despite my situation, which actually proved to be quite difficult. It's actually in that situation that I was arrested in August of 2015.
Right.
So the arrest was quite a surprise too. Well, not exactly a surprise because it was leaked in the press a few days before, but the news of it was a bit of a surprise. So, well, when the police came, I just followed them. From there, I went into being interrogated daily, for, I guess, 1 month and a half at first. Then charges were pressed. Actually, at first I was detained in the police station in near Shibuya. It's called the Mansebashi Police Station. So the first days of interrogation were 8 days of interrogation, 8 hours, sorry, of interrogation and just sleep. After 1 month and a half, when this stopped, actually, I went from being busy all day to not having anything to do. Actually, that was, I don't know exactly how to say this, actually. I mean, I don't have words to explain this, but when a few weeks later I was rearrested and interaction, daily interaction started again, I was almost grateful to have something to do again.
Right.
Except it's only listed for like 20 days. Then I was back in detention with nothing to do all day. The thing is, at this kind of point in time, I was in detention, but I didn't know how long this would take. I had no planned court appearance date. I was in detention and just waiting for something somewhere to happen. So this was actually quite, I don't know, been stressful, or I don't even know if it's the right word for this.
Yeah.
So actually I spent time in the police station until December 16th, where I moved to the Tokyo Detention Center, where I was moved from, actually the police station has not many cells, so you're always with someone, but the detention center had, I was put in a cell alone, and I would spend 7 months there. So I started basically to get used to this. I made sure to get books, pens and things for writing, so I could do something with my time, but still spending every day just reading or writing is kind of difficult, especially when you cannot meet anyone.
Does it affect your mental state?
I would say so. After this, when I was finally released on bail, I actually had quite a lot of trouble to adapt back to the outside life, basically.
Okay.
Well, there are some things that didn't bring bad memories at some times.
Okay. Well, let's unpack some of the story. Yeah. There's a lot to go through.
Yeah, sorry.
It's fine. There's a lot to go through. I've got a lot of questions. Yeah. I am going to want to go back to the point where you start to talk to Jed.
Yeah.
You start to discuss the takeover of Mt. Gox. Can you talk me through how that started, how the discussion started, and what the arrangement was between the two of you?
Well, so actually, when I started to get involved with Bitcoin, it was around 2010. I believe I was the first company actually to accept payments in Bitcoins, because most people out there were not exactly companies. I was acting as a very small entity, but still a company. And I started accepting Bitcoins for web hosting and domain name registration. And I started getting involved with the community, and some people, well, so I could help technically, so they came for me for some kind of help. And this actually included Jed, who asked me for some help to set up, like, for example, communication with banks, which provide very complex APIs and kind of things. So that's how I started to interact with Jed. And in January, I believe, of 2011, he emailed me asking me to keep it secret because it could cause a panic, but that he was considering to sell Mt. Gox, and asked me if I was interested. To which I replied that, of course, it's an interesting thing, but I don't have any money to go on. Even if it's a hosting company, it's not like I've got huge budget or anything. Actually, I thought it would be it, but a few days later, he came back to me, and we worked out a kind of transfer agreement where I wouldn't pay anything upfront. But which would come with a 6 month, I believe, revenue share. And Jed keeping 12% of a new company that would be created to hold Mt. Gox.
And the structure of the agreement had an indemnity clause in it, right?
I believe so, yes.
Right. And how much due diligence did you perform before the arrangement, or did you just kind of take it over without thinking about it too much?
Well, actually, at the time, Mt. Gox was well known as the only Bitcoin exchange out there. I've been running a business alone without much budget, so there were no real due diligence except for confirming Jed's identity. And, well, I used Mt. Gox myself, so I knew how it worked. So that's actually what was about it.
Was Mt. Gox insolvent when you took it over?
Well, I guess that would depend on your definition of insolvent. Actually, I didn't verify the cash assets because those were on Jed's private name. So I couldn't just ask him to send his personal bank account records. However, at the time, Mongox wasn't known to be, well, actually, in this time, there was no real discussion of this kind of issues with exchanges yet.
Were you aware of the full missing number of Bitcoin at the time you took over Mt. Gox?
At the time of the signature of the contract, I understood Mt. Gox was missing $50,000 because it was stolen by someone from Liberty Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
However, Jed assured me that should be it and told me he was quite sure there would be no other issue with this code.
What was the plan to recover the 50,000?
Well, basically from what Jade said, just running Mongox should recover this money soon enough.
Okay. Did you have the necessary skills to take over Mongox?
That's once again a very interesting question. If it's about skills about running a Bitcoin exchange, I'm actually pretty sure nobody had any experience at the time yet.
Mm-hmm.
As for running a business, I did run or get involved in different kind of business over the year, so I knew quite a few things about that. On the technical side, I could see Mongox could use quite a bit of help. Actually, the source code I got from Jed after the transfer was not really usable at it. But that's another story, I guess. Another question. Basically, in terms of running a regular business or fixing things technically with Mongox, of course, that's something I could do. However, at the time, Bitcoin was not worth as much as we could call this a financial business.
Do you think some people look back at the time of 2010 through to 2014 with 2018 eyes? And they consider the time you took over Bitcoin, they think about it as a time when Bitcoin is worth thousands of dollars rather than just a few dollars. And do you think that changes people's kind of views and opinions?
Actually, yes, I would think looking at Bitcoin and seeing as it was like $3,000 today make people think differently of Bitcoin even at the time. Despite actually Bitcoin was like 30 cents, I believe, in 2010. Someone sold a couple of pizza for 10,000 bitcoins. That's a very well-known undocumented event. 2011, Bitcoin actually more or less was around $1 at the time. So we're not talking about the same kind of scale anymore. If someone deposited like $1,000 on Mongox, it was huge. So there's very, very big difference of scale, I would say.
So the price accelerated quicker than perhaps the infrastructure and the team you had?
Yes, actually, I would say so. The price and the size of the market, the number of people using or trying to buy or sell bitcoins, accelerated very quickly. Mongox went from 3,000 users in March of 2011 to 60,000 in June, when there was the first well-documented hack of Mongox. From there, it only took 2 years to reach 1 million users.
What kind of team did you have around you, or were you doing it all?
When I took over Mongox in March, I was working alone, actually.
Okay.
However, I quickly hired more people. So by June, I actually had 4 people in the company, which was not enough to deal with the hack. So I actually asked for help. Many people from outside came to help with Mongox, including Roger Ver, or people from his company and other customers.
But you were already fighting daily fires at that point. I think that's what I've heard you say.
Yes. Actually, the first 3 months of Mongox was a lot of me fixing issues with Jet's code, because the way Mongox was made, there were a lot of very, basic mistakes or issues that may happen when you have maybe a handful of customers, what we call, for example, the waste conditions. So if two people placed a buy or sell order at the same time, they could end executing the same orders from the order book.
Okay.
So to fix this, ideally what would you would do is to have an execution queue and maybe move the whole execution outside of the main process. But I couldn't change Jets cause that much. So I just fix this with basically what we call a lock. So it would maybe make things a bit slower, but it avoid executing multiple orders multiple times. There were also a lot of rounding errors. So people could end with balances that didn't exactly make sense. Or when orders were executed multiple times, balance were not updated right because, updates balance were executed before. Well, after reading the balance for someone, they could get free Bitcoin, free money, or get less money than they should. What else? Yes, passwords were encrypted with a very, well, non-suitable way for passwords. So just what we call MD5. So that's something I changed to at probably one of my very first changes to move passwords to something that's, slightly better. Right. So yeah, there were a lot of things to fix with Mongox, and as people were using the website and more people were using the website, there were more reports of issues. Well, the very first person I hired actually was to help with the customer support because I couldn't fix things and answer emails at the same time.
In hindsight, do you think you probably should have closed Mt. Gox and rewritten it from scratch?
I would say so, actually. The first, well, seeing how Mongox was at the time, the issue there was with the system, I should have most likely not run this as it was. However, many of the issues were not visible at first, but only when reported from users. So there was no way for me to find all of this unless I spend a lot of time reading through all of the existing code.
Okay. Who is responsible for the failure and bankruptcy of Mt. Gox?
Well, that's a very wide question.
Mm-hmm.
The bankruptcy ultimately comes from the successful sieve of Bitcoin from Mt. Gox, which as a director I should have seen. I mean, there've been a lot of things to deal with and to look at. So I had to fix issues with banks and different other things. Well, I had to make some assumptions at the times that turned out to not work exactly the way they should have worked, especially with cold wallets and Bitcoin security. I mean, cold wallets were working fine, but the way Bitcoins were stolen from Mt. Gox worked in a way that happened even before Mt. Gox knew about, well, not because it's a bit of a complex thing, technically speaking. But basically, the hacker got inside Mt. Gox before I could move all of the system to new servers and managed to steal keys while staying undetected, which were assumed to not have been stolen and were being reused by some customers, which means that whenever they made deposits, the hacker would be able to steal those Bitcoins. But on the Mt. Gox side, there would appear some issue could appear. Like, because of this, if some customers were created more Bitcoin than they should, but of course nobody reported it. So in the end, the cold wallet was working well. Most of the system worked as expected, but the location where the SIF happened with very small amounts over a long period of time made this very difficult to detect. Even after Mt. Gox bankruptcy, when the trustee hired specialists to work on this, the US law enforcement, Japanese law enforcement worked on this, it took, well, years to find out exactly why Bitcoins were missing.
What was the total number of Bitcoins stolen from the cold wallet?
Well, actually they were not stolen from the cold wallet, but from the deposit system.
Mm-hmm.
And the total amount is believed to be between 500 and 600,000 Bitcoins.
And you state that was hard to detect.
Yes. At the time, those Bitcoins were supposed to be moved until to the cold wallet.
Mm-hmm.
So I assumed this was working because, well, I checked balance in the system, which were growing. The hot toilet, of course, was not supposed to grow, and it wasn't. That was, well, the way things were supposed to be at the time.
I guess people would say you should have noticed 500,000 bitcoins missing from the cold wallet. You should have known the balances. Is that a fair criticism?
Well, I cannot deny I should have moved the cold wallet to something better. The way the cold wallet was made in 2011 was using, well, technology of the time, which included printing private keys and the, well, public key equivalent on piece of papers, which were stored in bank safes or in secure locations to make sure that basically no one could look at this. The issue is just, well, at the time there was no key encryption, it was not standard. There was no BIP32 that would allow to make like one master seed and easily check how much there was on all the addresses by just keeping the public key element. The way things were, we only had, well, this at the time, discussion with people at the time were that basically it could be dangerous to keep the public keys around because no matter what kind of random source is used, there could be a way to work it. And when you find one public key matching private key you found from the, for example, insecure random generator, it's very easy if you get the other keys to just, well, continue running the random generator to find everything. So the main advice at the time was to not keep public keys either, which made very difficult to confirm how much was in the cold wallet.
So who is responsible for the failure of Mt. Gox?
Well, of course, I say I bear a large part of responsibility. The way, well, things were at the time, whoever didn't allow things to be done better, except BIP32 was released, I believe, end of 2012 or 2013. So, of course, it was new at the time, so I didn't believe at the time it was a good idea to just switch to new technology without it being more proved by time. But in hindsight, I would say it could have been a good idea to make it the, well, possible to see what's in the cold wallet. The other issue was with the servers themselves, which, well, actually were inherited from JED, but I should also have, well, checked security and improved the way things were secure on the servers.
So would you say there's a combination of responsibility here from you? There's fault in how you've maybe the lack of full due diligence in taking over Mt. Gox, mistakes you've made while running Mt. Gox. Part of the fault lays on the fact that this is new technology. You know, there's still hacks happening today, right?
Yeah.
You are essentially the guinea pig fall guy for original technology. And then also blame should be placed still with Jed. Is that a fair summary?
I would guess so, actually. So I don't think Jed expected at the time for the price to go the way it went. Nobody expected at the time. I mean, we had trust in Bitcoin. We believed in Bitcoin. But we never saw Bitcoin going from like $10 to $30 back in 2011. Or even reach $1,000 in 2014. Well, for Mt. Gox, it meant dealing with many, many more customers, banking issues. Suddenly, we're just some random business. We're very close to financial business, which meant governments approached us or went after us. So the kind of work this meant changed drastically over time. Well, as I said before, it was mostly an issue of dealing with fixing things daily. Well, I could think today of many ways this could have been done better, but I don't think at the time anyone had any idea of how things would go or what specifically to do to prevent this. One thing is that Mt. Gox actually blocked many, many kind of attacks from different kind of hackers. we improved security. We were often attacked by DDoS attacks. So I actually, Mongox went to a company specialized in protecting from these kind of attacks to make sure the website would continue working even under attack. We went through a lot of things, but I guess at the time, making the cold wallet auditable was not a priority at the very beginning because of the risk it involved. That's something that could have been changed if we knew about the way. If we knew it would have been important.
So I guess most people will hear about the reports of the maybe 10 most prominent hacks on Mt. Gox, and they'll look at something like the WiseSec report, but probably fail to appreciate maybe that there were the site was under constant attack, and they don't hear about all the attacks that maybe you thwarted. They only hear of the ones that got through. And this is I guess it's an industry where anybody who's running any kind of exchange is constantly under attack, and you were the first to try and fight back these attacks. So do you think sometimes maybe people don't appreciate that?
Oh, well, I guess actually quite a lot of people do not appreciate the way things are for exchanges even today with, well, of course, attacks, but also dealing with banks, dealing with financial entities, dealing with governments. Many other exchanges that came up while Mongox existed disappeared before Mongox went into bankruptcy. Some had issues with banks, some were just hacked. Like for example, one of the first Bitcoin wallet service, which was called MyBitcoin, was completely hacked and disappeared from circulation. I don't remember if it in 2011 or 12, but there were many, many hacks, and basically every single, company on internet is targeted daily. And Bitcoin business even more because there's a much higher, profit to be made from it. But for example, even chat networks are often hacked just to, for example, someone doesn't like someone else on the chat network, or just get the whole network down to shut them up, or websites. I mean, DDoS attacks are very common on the internet. Sometimes you hear in the news that some hackers managed to put down the FBI website, I think a few years ago. So basically, internet is a dangerous place because everyone can try and go and attack anyone else. Speaking of attacks, by the way, I forgot about one kind, swatting too. YouTubers just attacking each other or kind of things. So yeah, the world is a dangerous place, and being an exchange actually puts a big target on one's back, which means that there would be that many more people trying to target this kind of businesses.
Have you taken enough responsibility for what's happened? One of the common things I hear from people is that you've tried to defer blame for what happened to other people or to the technology. Do you think you've taken enough responsibility for what happened?
Well, I don't know actually what enough is. So, and I guess it depends on for everyone. My goal is to just not stop doing what I can do as long as there's something I can do. So when I was running Mongox, I first tried to make sure everything was running smoothly. Obviously, it was not enough. Mongox went to bankruptcy. So I did my best to make sure the bankruptcy would run smoothly and as fast as possible, which was, because I cannot control everything, of course. Didn't go as good as it went, could be, but still I spent a lot of time getting in touch with creditors and helping them, explaining how to fight claims. I tried to be as available as possible. When we went with the issue of Bitcoin being, having more value than wouldn't be needed for the bankruptcy, one thing I actually did, which a lot of people didn't like at first, is I said, people actually asked me if I would get anything, do I pledge it back to the creditors? And my reply was usually that, of course I could do it, but it would be much better for Mongox to, for example, switch to civil rehabilitation. And that will require effort from the creators. So I'm not going to pledge anything at this point. Please work and try to make this a civil rehabilitation. And I guess not everyone liked it. But considering that if I was to pledge anything, it would mean that funds went from Mongox to Tibans and then to me. A lot of people would get their hands on it first. A lot of it would go into taxes, because in Japan, payments from share you own is taxed like, I believe, 30%. Of course, even if it came to me, a lot of people would just sue me to try to get their hands on it first. So it would be just an unending battle and nobody would profit from it. So rather than just having people feel safe and not do anything, my idea was to tell them to act.
Okay, we'll come back to that.
Okay.
Sifting through the various hacks and trying to understand the timeline from 2011 through to 2014, it seems to me that you inherited a broken system with a debt, and it seemed to me that that hole, which the debt was based around, kept digging and digging and getting bigger and bigger, and it feels like you were fighting fires and chasing your tail and trying to recover losses. And perhaps one of the things that worked against you is not at any point just coming clean and saying, we've got a problem here. It's almost like the problem, the more you try to fix the problem, the more it escalated. Is that a fair assessment?
I would guess so. Actually, there are reasons for things going this way.
Okay.
So first about, the way Mongox was when I, took over Mongox, of course, there was this issue with $50,000 missing. There was another 80,000 Bitcoin missing, which Jed told me one morning on Skype.
Was that the, did that go missing during the handover period?
Actually, it went missing at the, mostly at the end of the handover period.
Okay.
Around the same time, Jed sent me the password to the server.
Yes. So what do you think happened there?
Well, that's difficult to say because we'd have need to run a more proper forensic investigation on the server. But what was clearly visible is that someone managed to transfer 80,000 bitcoins from the Bitcoin client running on the Mongox server to an outside address.
They've never moved, have they? They're still at that address.
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah.
It's an address starting with 1FEEX something.
What is the value of those Bitcoin at the time?
Well, it was slightly less than $8,000 actually.
Okay.
Because Bitcoin was like 0.95 or something.
But if those Bitcoins aren't recovered and the value goes up, it becomes a bigger problem to solve.
Indeed.
And so those 80,000 Bitcoin go missing during the handover, and Jed's response is, this is your problem now, Mark?
Well, actually, more or less, I tried to ask him how to handle this or what we could do, but because I already signed a contract with him and there was a full indemnification for any kind of issues, I couldn't really bring this up anywhere. So my best shot at this was just to listen to his advice, or at least that's what I believed at the time. So he gave me, he sent me an email where basically there were three options to go with this. One was just to hope and wait. One was to try to get an investor in. And actually, at the time, he sent me, probably asked me some, gave me a name. But actually, a company based in the Cayman or somewhere. Well, it didn't really sound a good idea to just get some random company inside on. And the third option was actually to transfer the new Bitcoin debt into US dollar debt by just trading it over. So that's basically the mail he sent me.
Okay.
Next up, I talked to Mark more about the collapse of Mt. Gox and his thoughts on the hack, But before that, I have a message from my show sponsors. So, with BlockFi this week, I wanted to remind you of some of the most important things about them and why I'm such a big fan. And today, I want to talk about the experience of using the products, because I didn't just accept their advertising dollar. I've actually used it. I've tried it. I've signed up for a loan. And I'm telling you now, it could not be easier. The design is amazing. It was in four very easy steps. I just selected the loan amount, I entered my personal information, I agreed to the terms of the loan, and then I submitted and was approved within minutes. It was really smooth, and it's backed up by some great customer service. So if you are interested in a crypto-backed loan, well, BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender servicing customers worldwide, including 47 states, and their interest rates start as low as 4.5%. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000, and applying takes less than 2 minutes. So you know the drill. Check them out at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, which is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid. And I've got another new advertiser. So let's talk about the Mighty Cash app, and a big thanks to the team there for supporting my work this week with these special Mt. Gox shows. I explained to them what I'm doing, asked if they'd be interested in sponsoring, and they agreed immediately and wanted to help me get out to Japan and do the interview with Mark. So a big thanks to them. So what is Cash App? Do you know it? Have you got it on your phone? Well, Cash App is the first traditional peer-to-peer payments app to support Bitcoin. How cool is that? It comes with most of the features of a traditional bank account, like the ability to direct deposit your paycheck into the app, to have a physical, customizable debit card linked to spend from, and the ability to earn 10% back at places like Whole Foods with Cash Boost. And this can be used in tandem with your Bitcoin balance. There is no app out there quite like it. The experience of buying and selling Bitcoin is so easy. It literally requires only two clicks, and you always receive your Bitcoin instantly. And why do I love them? Well, they are committed to supporting the Bitcoin ecosystem, as we have seen recently with the Lightning Torch. Available on Apple and Google Play stores, download by searching Cash App, which is CASHAPP.
So over time, there's a number of hacks, different kinds of problems on the system. The debt of the Bitcoin to the company is growing. Are you starting to worry at any point, thinking, how do I... Because you're operating a fractional reserve at that point. Are you starting to worry at all, thinking you'll never be able to recover this? Are you worried that the price is going to go so high that you're in a position where you can't pay all the creditors? Are you starting to worry whilst operating the exchange?
Well, actually, I would say I was worried starting day one.
Right.
Because it's a very big thing to take over. Suddenly there's like 80,000 Bitcoin missing on top of the $50,000. So it's not, well, wasn't much of a difference at the time, until Bitcoin went to $30, and it was much more of an issue. Well, basically everything that happened during running Mt. Gox, from banks closing Mt. Gox bank accounts, governments trying to stop Mt. Gox from operating and so on, was a source of worry. And things I tried to address with the best of my abilities and as fast as I could.
How much can you talk about Willybot?
Well, unfortunately, it's part of an ongoing trial right now in Japan, so I'm afraid I cannot reply to this.
Okay. So the debt's growing. You're obviously getting worried. Is anyone else in the business aware of the full extent of the missing Bitcoin, or is this something you've just kept to yourself and kept away from everybody else?
Well, actually, I made sure I would be the only one knowing about this.
Okay.
Mostly because I believe it was my responsibility as someone who took over Mt. Gox at the time. Just was my job to get this cleared. And, well, actually, based on the calculation I made at the time, the debt should have been gone by 2013.
Mm-hmm. Based on trading fees and buying Bitcoin back?
Basically.
And maybe something else we can't talk about, but
yeah.
Okay. But that didn't happen, right?
Well, that didn't happen because in 2014, someone who actually used to run another exchange, came to the Mt. Gox chat and explained that it was possible to steal Bitcoins from Mt. Gox with transaction malleability. This prompted Mt. Gox to stop allowing transfers and to go through a full audit of all Bitcoin and Gold Wallet, where it became clear because we're missing.
So that was the time you first became aware?
Yes.
So at the time of the audit,
yeah,
you were still short. You were aware that you were short an amount of Bitcoin. You hadn't recovered all the lost Bitcoin up until that date. So how short were you in terms of Bitcoin at that date?
Actually, in terms of calculation at that date, considering all, well, Mongox made about 200,000 Bitcoins so far, and we knew about less than 100,000 missing. So there should have been actually more Bitcoins.
Right. So you at that point, you believe you had a surplus.
Yes.
Without realizing your own Bitcoin had already been stolen.
Yes.
So you start the audit, and talk me through the process of the audit and what you start to discover and what you start to feel.
Well, basically, there was different parts of the audit because Mongox, over time, had accumulated many kind of different kind of cold wallets. But the main part is actually paper-based, which involved to check, being in a secure environment and scanning private keys, which I believe there were probably something like 200 to 300 sheets of paper at the time. So, job of basically scanning and checking on the blockchain how much there is. For this purpose, actually, I made a specific piece of software, which just from the private key generates a public key, and look it up. So, checking all the code actually took some time, mostly because I had to be at the office and deal with many other things. At the same time, we also made something to work around the transaction malleability, which is actually called the we basically created a new transaction hash that wouldn't be affected by transaction malleability with the help of a Bitcoin core developer. So it took, I believe, about a week to go through all of the cold wallets on, not all of the cold wallets, most of the cold wallets, and conclude there were not enough Bitcoins to continue. From that point, Mongox started to discuss with the court, going into bankruptcy or civil rehabilitation. And at the same time, we approached big names in the Bitcoin world to see if there was any way to, save Mongox at this point.
So at first, there was a belief of around 750,000 customer Bitcoins missing, yeah, and 100,000 Mt. Gox Bitcoin. But did you realize all was gone at the same time, or were you just like checking wallets and realizing over time, there's some? Explain to me how this actually happened.
Well, as I say, it takes some time to scan all of the wallets. However, as I ran through the addresses and find only small amounts or no amounts, I started to come into, realizing that things were looking very bad. Actually, nearing the end, I was afraid to even scan addresses. Not knowing would be better than knowing that there was bad news.
Would you say that probably is a reflection of sometimes maybe how you ran the business as well? Would it be fair to say perhaps you ran away from problems or kind of kicked the problem down the road and moved on to the next problem?
Well, for Mongox, I wouldn't say so, because most of the issues outside of the missing Bitcoins initially coming in, we take all this head on and fixed most of the issues out there. Or even the US seizure of $5 million from Mongox was about to be solved by the time Mongox went into bankruptcy.
Okay. So you realize 850,000 Bitcoin are missing.
Yes.
About $500 million. It's the world's biggest heist.
Yeah. Well, at the time, I was not thinking about if it was the world's biggest or not. I wasn't sure what to think or what to do. With the help of Mongox lawyers at the time, Mongox went into the civil rehabilitation filing. From there, we went on to taking some time to reanalyze everything.
Do you think during the time when it was happened, you were being honest enough with customers, or had you had a panic and didn't know what to do? Talk me through the time when you've discovered Bitcoins are missing and you're putting messages on the website, or you're...
Well,
What's your kind of thought process during that time? What did you do right? What did you do wrong?
Actually, the main thing that happened at the time when we first saw the issue with the, connection malleability, we discussed with our lawyers who advised to go through the full audit and not disclose anything at the time.
Okay.
So we did explain, we found about the transaction malleability, we explained why Mongox stopped transfers, and what steps we're taking to solve this, which means solving technically speaking and making sure the system would be safe before it's restarted. But in the meantime, during the audit, as what Bitcoin were found to be missing, we approached the court, and the initial advice from the court was to continue running the business as usual until on the, I believe, 24th, the court asked us to just stop the website. So it just became a blank page at the time. And from there, it was only a few days until the bankruptcy was announced.
And then all chaos ensues.
Yes.
So if you look back on the period of 2011 to 2014, if you're really honest and fair with yourself, what are the fairest criticisms you can put on yourself, and what should you have done differently?
Well, I guess the way missing Bitcoin were dealt with was the biggest issue of there. The biggest issue that caused, well, not that caused, but that remains to be discussed. At the time, so Bitcoins and dollars were missing. The only advice I had at the time was from Jed, which was to basically try to do something to solve the situation over time, but not make any kind of waves or anything, because it would disrupt the market. After a while, when we saw, for example, when Bitfinex was hacked and the issuance of tokens to just replace whatever was hacked and recover over time, well, it shows that there's actually a much better way to deal with kind of issues. So I believe anyway today it's almost a standard procedure for exchanges that get hacked, way of doing things. But at the time, well, I went with whatever I had, which meant trying to get the exchange to continue running, making profit in order to make sure everyone's getting whole again.
Okay. Talk me through the Japanese bankruptcy process. Talk me through how it works. Talk me through the process that you've been through with taking Mt. Gox through that. And then also, can you talk to me about this very strange situation where most companies who go through a bankruptcy don't see their assets inflate by 100 extra in that time, which changed the whole dynamic of the situation? Can you talk me through that?
When Mongox actually filed for civil rehabilitation on February 28th of 2014, actually, we didn't have many assets. We had some $30 million worth in cash assets and a few dozen bitcoins. One thing that changed things quite a bit is actually a few weeks later, we added 200,000 bitcoins to the bankruptcy estate, which when Mongox went into bankruptcy on April 24th, 2014, were part of the estate and were evaluated at that time. So I believe around $500 a Bitcoin. Bitcoin was worth more or less this kind of amount. Mongox should have been like 4 to 5 times more Bitcoins. So even if the price increased 3 or 4-fold, it would have been fine within the scope of the bankruptcy. From there, it went on as a standard bankruptcy procedure. People made claim. All the claims were, of course, valued in Japanese yen. regarding the Bitcoins, the trustee actually tried to find ways he could distribute Bitcoins as Bitcoins. So they were not sold at the time. However, in 2017, I believe, or 2018, when Bitcoin price went over $2,500, it means that the value of the Mongox estate was higher than the total of all the claims, which actually is not unheard of in bankruptcy. Sometimes companies or individuals have real estate that ends being sold for 3 or 5 times more than the estimated amount. And actually, what happens typically in this kind of case is whatever remains is paid to the individual or the company shareholders, because it means they were not actually bankrupt. But for Mongok's case, it's a slightly more difficult question. The easiest solution for this was just to go back to civil rehabilitation, because it would not only make it possible to reevaluate the claims at a more accurate value, but also it would make it easier to distribute Bitcoins as Bitcoins to creditors, which would please most of the creditors.
Could you legally yourself have claimed the surplus from the bankruptcy?
Not myself anyway, because I'm not directly the owner of Mongox.
So Tiban.
But Tiban anyway, there's no reason to claim it because it's part of the shares. So whoever owns the shares would have been receiving this kind of surplus. So there was no claim to file. It just whatever remains at the end of the bankruptcy when all creditors are paid. So the company is seen as having no debt anymore, is paid back to the owner of the company.
So it could have been paid back to you?
It could have been paid back to me. However, based on my, discussion with the trustee and the court, I helped make sure it wouldn't happen.
Okay. There's a couple of spanners in the works with the whole process in terms of creditors and things holding things up. Let's talk about those now. So firstly, let's talk about CoinLab and Peter Vasenis, who is the only person I haven't been able to get hold of during this process of trying to interview various people. Talk me through the CoinLab legal situation, what Peter is claiming, and what your thoughts on it are.
Well, maybe I should start with the beginning of the story between Peter and Mongox, which is a story actually that starts in 2010. In Costa Rica, where Jed was, and where Peter came with him to maybe walk or try to do something with Mongox. So I wasn't there, so I don't know exactly how it went. But after taking over Mongox, I got an email from Peter telling me that he actually owns half of Mongox and should have been paid half of whatever Jed was paid. So I forwarded this to Jed, and Jed responded to Peter and me just saying, "What the fuck?" basically. After a few exchanges, actually, Peter Vasenis stopped sending emails, and I completely forgot about him until in 2012, Mongox was getting bigger. We saw the situation in the US to be increasingly difficult. We discussed with three different lawyers, and we got three different opinions. So some lawyers thought that being in the US would be fine as long as we're in Japan. Another firm told us we would need a MSB license, so a money service business license. Our main lawyer just told us you need a MTB, money transmitter business license, which means having an office in every single state and huge cost. So we saw the cost being $10 to $50 million, which is something we couldn't do. Around the same time, CoinLab approached us. Initially, actually offered to take over Mongox management, which was not really interesting in itself. But after some discussion, offered to just handle the legal situation in the US by representing Mongox and being the Mongox USA front. So, of course, since there's anyway need to be in the US to do this, it was easier for us to just ask of CoinLab to do this. At first, they seemed to have some interesting ideas on how to deal with that. So we started drafting a contract, which I believe was signed a few months later in 2013, where, actually, no, the contract was signed end of 2012, where CoinLab would have, to, of course, to comply with all laws and regulations, and, well, represent Mongox in the US. So the contract was signed. However, all, well, what we saw is that CoinLab didn't seem to be compliant. By the time we approach the time where CoinLab would need to actually go live, the FinCEN published a guidance explaining that Bitcoin exchange were indeed MTB, and we need to get the MTB license. So our first thing was to contact CoinLab and to ask them what they thought about this and what was their plan to comply with this. However, they didn't provide a response to this. Their initial response that, well, licensing is not really required for startups. Then, well, the guidance was quite clear on this, and our lawyers were not convinced, but whatever CoinLab said. We offered them to continue working with them, and we needed them to provide us a timeline on how they plan to comply. And a few months later, I don't remember exactly when, they just filed a lawsuit against Mongox, claiming we didn't, well, we didn't allow them to go live without a license, because it was a clear violation of the contract, and it was a huge risk for Mongox. They sued Mongox over this. We filed a counter complaint, I believe, explaining that not only they didn't comply with the contract, but they started doing live customers, sending millions of dollars while still in test. From there, the lawsuit moved rather slowly. By the time Mongox went into bankruptcy, it was still ongoing, so it was stayed by the bankruptcy.
Did you stop Peter creating a $16 billion business?
I don't think so. I mean, when CoinLab approached us, they actually failed their first venture, I believe, which was to try to let game companies include the mining software in their games to use the gamer's GPU to make money. I don't think CoinLab ever had an actual business, running business ever.
So what is the status of the lawsuit here? Because it's holding up the distribution to creditors right now.
Yes, well, the lawsuit right now is stayed, which means that it cannot move forward by itself. CoinLab initially filed a claim for the lawsuit's amount of $75 million plus interest in the Mongox bankruptcy. They made a similar claim to the TBAN bankruptcy. Well, their claim, of course, was rejected by the trustees. So they made a petition for assessment, which allows them to ask the court to assess the claim again. However, the petition for assessment wasn't over by the time Mongox went into civil rehabilitation again. So right now they filed a claim again, around $16 billion claim, which was rejected again, and they've got until March 7th, I believe, to file or not file a petition for assessment.
So that's about a similar time to your own next steps with your own legal position, right?
Yes.
So March is a big month.
Yes, March 7th is the deadline for filing petition of assessment for CoinLab, and the deadline, well, there's the verdict for me on the 15th, and there is the creditors meeting on the 20th.
Right, okay. Brock Pierce, I obviously spoke with Brock last week, and I guess from my position, I can't fully get to the bottom of what his incentives are or his motivation is. It seems to change depending on which interview I read or watch, and it changed during the time I spoke to him. Can you give me a background to the Brock situation? Because there was at a time where you did make an agreement with him. So can you give me the background, where we are now with Brock, and what your own personal opinion is on what's going on here?
Yes. Well, one thing I'm going to correct is we actually don't have an agreement with Brock, just the letter of intention we received from
him. He seems to think, though, that is a legally binding an agreement. And I'll tell you what he said to me. His view was, in the fire sale of a business where something's going crazy and he's stepping in to help you, he said, you don't always have a full legal contract. Sometimes you operate with a very limited letter of intention. And he said he spent hundreds and hundreds of thousands at the time on PR and press and getting people in to help fix the situation with Mt. Gox. So how much of that is true?
Well, so I go back to the background with Brock Pierce, actually. Mm-hmm. Since he approached Mt. Gox back in late 2013 to early 2014 about expanding Mt. Gox business to China, explaining he had a lot of contacts with China and could, well, make Mt. Gox work very well over there. When Mt. Gox went into bankruptcy, he approached us again and offering to take over the bankruptcy and, well, basically making Mt. Gox a better, well, get a good ending, basically. So the first step to this was, of course, to try to buy the Mt. Gox shares. Of course, it would need the approval from the Tokyo District Court and different other things. So the first thing we came with was the letter of intention, where he explained the situation. Basically, there are two, well, I believe there are different important things on this, but the two last paragraphs of the letter of intention are usually the ones that mention this kind of talks. Because the one before last is about getting the approval of the Tokyo District Court for the transfer of the shares, which actually we offered Brock to do for him, but he didn't reply on this. So at this point, I do not, well, I never saw the approval of the Tokyo District Court. And the last one was within 45 days of the LOI, to negotiate and enter an agreement for the actual transfer of the shares, which didn't happen either. So the last communication we had on this is, well, initially we wanted to work with Brock and signed his LOI, sent it to our lawyers too. Our lawyers told us that this would have to go through the Tokyo District Court first. So the process would have been to... it was on a Friday, but to rescind the LOI, send it to the Tokyo District Court. We talked initially to the Tokyo District Court and they told us they would be able to give the approval by Monday, then sign it again with date Monday. And the person representing Brock Pierce at the time told us, yes, no problem, we're going to get you this back to you. However, I didn't get any reply after that. So the rescission letter for the LOI was never signed by Brock, and we never were able to talk to the district court about getting this approved.
So there's a period of silence after that.
Yes.
And then when does Brock come back into the picture?
Well, the first time I saw him coming back into the Mt. Gox story was with the appearance of Gox Corp, which was a entity which made some kind of peer in some news site and made a very lavish party for the Bitcoin 10 years with a big golden Gox letters on the cake and, well, ladies blowing the candles and stuff like this. So that completely kind of feels foreign to me. But part of the people who were there and were shown on the videos includes Brock Pierce. And from there, I didn't... Well, he spoke about this, and there were some videos of him talking on Twitter too, I believe. But this didn't really take. I think most people didn't really feel about the lavish party that was put around this. A couple of months ago, then Gox Rising was created, with once again Brock Pierce appearing and doing a talk about how Mt. Gox can just rise back from the ashes and everything. And I guess that's when he really came back in the picture and, well, claimed he could revive Mongax.
I first met Brock in Las Vegas. I was there for World CryptoCon. I was invited to a meeting to announce new action by some of the creditors. So it was in a hotel room in Aria. I got up there and it was a DJ, cocktail bar, booth babes with Bitcoin signs on. A very strange situation then Brock came in. So it probably sounds similar to the one you had.
Yes, that would be the Gox Corp event, which was managed, I believe, by some lawyer called Oliver Wright, I believe.
Yes, who's based out of Los Angeles.
Yes.
Yeah.
Actually, he contacted me on Twitter at some point too, asking about 35,000 Bitcoin creditor, which I didn't know about. So it took some time and digging at the Tokyo District Court to find out who it was. But I believe it's about a person called Roman Hosaim.
Mm-hmm.
I found one press release about this also on the internet. Actually looked at this claim, but I couldn't confirm it because it lists a different number of Mongox accounts with login names. None of those actually exist, except the first one.
Right. Okay, so back to Brock. Brock said to me his objectives were based around his love of Bitcoin. He loves Bitcoin. He feels the story of Mt. Gox has harmed it. He feels like a better story can be told about Mt. Gox and wants to revive it. So that's his goal one. And his second goal was quite direct. He said he wants to make sure that Mark Karpeles doesn't get any of the money out of the Mt. Gox liquidation and civil rehabilitation. So how do you feel about both of his goals?
Well, actually, when Brock came to me, his first discussion was about how he could help me improve my, well, personal image and make Mongox a better story. Well, reading a little bit about it, I saw he wanted to do different things, relaunch Mongox, issue shares as an ICO. So he explained actually to me that he already done this before, ICOs are securities, so it's fine, he got the experience to do it. Of course, he didn't tell me anything about trying to make sure I didn't get anything. I didn't raise the question because at this point, you know, I wasn't planning on getting anything. So that's one subject that wasn't talked about. However, well, based on what he said to me, actually, he came in this very office and we talked. We talked about CoinLab too. He told me he could probably get CoinLab to back down. He was not very friendly with Peter Vesnes. He actually got Peter Vesnes out of the Bitcoin Foundation and told me a few things about this. Well, since we didn't know yet who was a big creditor in the Mongox bankruptcy, well, I had a very good idea it was most likely CoinLab, but I wasn't sure they actually made a $16 billion claim that sounded maybe too much even for Peter. So I think maybe I can go to the court and confirm and I can tell you if it was Peter or not. So this, we just left this office, went to the court. I asked him actually to wait outside because only creditors or people related to the bankruptcy can go inside. It took more than 1 hour, maybe 2 hours to get the documents, but I could confirm at the time that CoinLab did indeed make a $16 billion claim. So I just came out, told him. We just talked a little bit more and just parted ways. But then the next day, or maybe a few days later, I saw an article in Bitcoin news website where Brock Pierce was saying like he could revive Mongox and how I was a bad guy and everything. And that was quite different from his initial story. So I didn't really trust, I didn't really trust him much to begin with, but that basically gave me the clear cut of, well, I think what he's saying directly to me and what he's actually saying outside being completely different. And from there, it turned out that way more than just this story about what he was saying was false. So, of course, there's this claim of owning Mongox, which when he made it, I immediately replied on Twitter because someone asked me to confirm, is it true? I told him no. I mean, we did have a LOI at some point that was on a lot of conditions of getting approval from the court and negotiating, getting an agreement done. But this never went further than that. Well, there's actually so many things in this, like he initially wanted to file a new CR plan, and then he says he's not going to file a CR plan, but this website still says he's going to file a CR plan. There's no way to know exactly what he really wants to do anymore. I'm not sure either. I would guess the ICO would be a goal that would bring, of course, a lot of image and money in. So that sounds like the most, well, credible part of everything as far as what he told me about what he wants to do and what I see in the media. But for the rest, I'm actually really not sure.
So what I don't understand is, obviously I wasn't aware he had come here and had a meeting with you. And, you know, hearing you explain that now, I'm trying to understand how he's gone from talking to you about wanting to revive Mt. Gox and help you with your own personal image. A few weeks later, he's in an interview with me, showing nothing but hatred towards you and wanting to make sure that you don't get any money out of Mt. Gox. What's happened in those few weeks, do you think, that's made Brock change in that way?
Well, I would guess what made it really change his mind was the way we fought over Twitter. When he first explained, he first posted about owning Mt. Gox, I replied, no, it's not true. We had a few exchanges on this. He said something about not wanting to let me get $700 million, which I don't really know where he got this from. I guess maybe from the bankruptcy, but I mean, it's not news anymore, and it's not true since middle of 2018. From there, so I just explained to him, no, it's not like this anymore. Went into more of this argument, and for him asking me who would be more fit to handle this, if it was you or me. And when there's no need for this, the trustee is already in charge of this process. And the Tokyo District Court is overseeing all of this, and I believe it's the most neutral way to handle this issue, rather than having someone just stepping on, maybe with some kind of goals, like running an ICO, which obviously would be for profit purpose, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so I don't think anymore, well, there's anything Brock can bring into the bankruptcy. Most of the things I've seen announced he could do were actually things that were already done by other people or are being done right now by other people. So if rewriting Mt. Gox history means just seeing everyone was saved thanks to Brock Pierce, I don't think it's a good thing. Because, well, a lot of people are involved in this. A lot of people lost a lot with Mt. Gox. Many creators are fighting very hard to try to make things, to give this whole story a better ending. Improving Mt. Gox, ending isn't just some scenario writing and, going into the news and just pushing a new story. It's actually acting on, everything creators have been doing so far, getting Mt. Gox into severe rehabilitation, getting sure they know about what's happening, are very important parts of, getting Mt. Gox in the right direction, and just pushing, false information or giving people false hopes, is not the way of reaching this, conclusion.
It seems to me from your AMA and having spoken to you and this, it seems you've been humbled quite a bit by the process. Your intentions now are only good. Do you think you've been misjudged or misrepresented?
Well, that's something responding by myself to this is kind of difficult. I know a lot of people judge me very harshly, especially right after the bankruptcy. I received, as I said before, a lot of death threats and very unkind messages. But I've been working with creators and with different people to try to get things in the good direction in the bankruptcy. I did actually have creators thank me for helping them. I believe my actions today are, speaking louder than anything I could say. So I'm still anyway going to continue to try to do whatever I can do to make sure the bankruptcy goes in the good direction, which means distributing as much as possible of the assets as fast as possible to as many creditors as possible. I would obviously don't have a full control of the situation, but I can still help because I'm in Japan. I know what's happening with the court. I do get some information on the process, so I make sure I can let creditors know as much as possible about what I can tell them. I'm trying to make sure people like Brock don't take advantage of creditors by trying to sell them dreams. I don't know Brock's full intentions yet, so I cannot say for sure. But based on the number of lies and the way he's been acting, I don't think there's anything good for creditors going with Brock.
Yeah, something quite interesting with the creditors as well. I mean, I haven't spoken to many of them directly, but I did read the entire AMA. And what was quite interesting is there was little to no ill will or anger towards you in that. And I don't know if this is time, like over time people just become a bit more relaxed, or if people have become a little bit more, I don't know, they're now judging 2014 with a fairer eye. Do you still get any kind of ill will towards you, or are you tending to find that people are actually being kind of okay with you?
Well, actually, I think time actually helped a lot in, helping people to heal and start to take some distance from everything that happened at the time. One of the creators were very, very angry at me, even sent me at the time a message about how he would kill and cook my cat. Okay. And actually contacted me and said, I'm so sorry, I don't want to hurt your cat anymore, and I'm sorry about that. I replied to him, it's okay, I know you were angry, I mean. And he sent me, oh, thank you very much for forgiving me. And I mean, people who act at the time were obviously under a very lot of, stress, and it was a difficult situation for everyone. So I can understand people would be angry and say things they don't actually mean at the time. So many of the people who just contacted me either needed help, so I put them in touch with people who could help, or I helped them by introducing them lawyers in Japan, explaining how to file claims, what were the deadlines. Even today, when someone recently posted on Twitter, it's too late to file a claim, I tell them, yeah, maybe you can still, the trustee has said they can still accept claims. So I tell them to just file and see what happens, because if they don't file anyway, nothing will happen anyway.
Okay.
So that's basically what I'm trying to do today. I've got, compared to what I got in terms of messages at the time, I got a lot, much better feedback from people now.
So tell me what's going to happen over the next coming kind of weeks and months, and how does this all close out, Mark?
Well, right now the next step would be the creators choosing a civil rehabilitation plan, which basically is going to say or define how the civil rehabilitation will proceed with the distribution and the end of life of Mongox. There's no way to say for sure yet what plans will be submitted, because the deadline is not passed yet. The deadline is in April 24th or 26th, I don't remember exactly. But starting that time, I understand creditors have been working together with the trustee to get a kind of master plan that would make sure everyone is happy. All creditors get as many Bitcoin as soon as possible. The different kind of things that could happen that would make this more difficult. One thing is, I don't know if any other creators are planning to file plans. Actually, not only creators, anyone can file a plan. So it's possible a sponsor out there will appear and just file a plan. Also unlikely, because in order to get the plan approved, you need to get the creators' vote, which means you need to communicate with the creators and have a good image with the creators. So that's one thing we don't know yet. There's another issue with this is, even if the plan is approved, the status of CoinLab and their 16 billion $1 claim could mean that we need to wait until this is solved to move forward with any kind of a distribution. Because if CoinHub's claim is approved, then they need to receive $16 billion, which would mean all creditors get nothing. So the way the court does is, even if the CoinHub claim is obviously meritless, they still need a final decision on this. So they cannot just say, yes, we know CoinHub is not a claim we need to care about. We just do this. This is not something the court can say. They need everything to be, well, on black or white.
Okay. Let's try and think 5 years forward now. This hope that's all over. Let's hope the CoinLab lawsuit is dropped. Let's hope all the creditors have received their distribution back. Kind of where do you want to be in 5 years' time? What do you want to be doing? What's going to be coming like next year?
Well, for me personally, I don't think I'm going to be involved in cryptocurrencies anymore.
Okay.
I had enough of this what kind of business. But there's still many things I like to do. And I mean, I can code and build things. I'm working right now at a new company, London Cross Media, building new things and working on new businesses for the future. London Trust Media, I mean, we're a company, we work on protecting people's privacies, so we're not that different from what Bitcoins do, but it's slightly different ways of going to it.
Okay, you got any final comments, anything you want to say before we close out?
Yes, I hope very much that CoinLab and Peter Business will just stop their claim. Once again, I'll say to everyone involved with Mongo that I'm very sorry the way things went. I very much wish I could just go back and fix things so Mongo doesn't just go the way it went. But there's only so much I can do, so I'll just continue helping and making sure everyone gets as much help as they can and the bankruptcy sees the distribution as soon as possible.
Okay, so how was that? That's quite a long interview. I think it's the longest one I've ever done, actually. And also, just a note, when doing a video interview, it's very different from an audio interview. You're very conscious that there is a camera on you, even though you don't really see me in this one. You're very conscious that it's on you. And also, you don't have the chance to post-edit as much, so I was trying much harder to articulate my questions with less ums and ahs beforehand. So anyway, that was a very different experience, but I hope you enjoyed it. And I also wanted to share my thoughts on Mark, as I've received so many DMs and emails this week with people expressing opinions on him and questions they wanted to ask. And I didn't get to cover everything I wanted to. Really, I could have probably done two or three interviews like this with Mark. There are so many of my questions I didn't get through. But for me, it was just about getting a sense of Mark on where he sees himself in the whole collapse of Mt. Gox, rather than going through the weeds of everything. So while many people still hold a lot of anger towards him, and I've been told he is a liar and a scammer and a thief and a fool, you know, every kind of accusation thrown at him to me privately, I've tried to give him the benefit of the doubt and understand what happened. So I've tried to take into consideration that it was the first real Bitcoin exchange. Nobody really had any experience of running one like this. There was no kind of case studies of things people had done or what they'd learned from. And also the price was much lower. I mean, when Jed launched the site, I think Bitcoin traded at 6 cents and he transferred the site to Mark within 6 months. So I'm trying to look at it with that perspective and not with the perspective of somebody who's owned a $20,000 Bitcoin. Now, listen, I'm not excusing Mark. I just really don't think he had any idea what he was taking on, and he probably could not foresee what was coming for the site and for Bitcoin. I feel like he probably took over something that was broken and he didn't have the full set of skills required to manage the site, both technically and in terms of management as a company, and a hole got dug and that hole got deeper and deeper, and he didn't also have the skills to kind of navigate his way outside of that. Has he lied? Maybe. Probably. Who knows for sure? I mean, I think in situations like this, it's not so much if a person is dishonest, it's down to self-preservation. And I think perhaps some of, you know, the ways he sees the history or the way he tells a story is that. And I have met and interviewed a whole bunch of people since I've been doing this podcast, and the take I have on Mark is that he accepts responsibility, but at the same time does want to share a bit of the blame to others, or to the fact that this was kind of like a new industry and these are new technologies he was dealing with. I mean, even today, exchanges are still getting hacked and mistakes are still being made, even though we have years of experience here. I genuinely believe Mark now just wants to see the best for the creditors, wrap this up and move on with his life. And despite the hack being under his watch, and despite the size of it, he has still had to endure a lot. He's had death threats, prison, and his life's essentially been on pause for years. And now I'm sure a bunch of people say he deserves this, and you know, everyone is entitled to their opinion. I just don't think it's as simple as saying Mark is a big scammer or Mark is a fraud. I think it's a much more complex case than that. And I think, ideally, I probably want to do a follow-up interview and go into a bit more detail in other areas. I don't see him as a hardcore criminal or a scammer. I just see someone who made a bunch of mistakes. Look, huge mistakes. Mistakes that have cost hundreds of millions of dollars to people. But I think he was just somebody who was massively out of his depth and didn't have the skills to fix it. So listen, I'm more than happy to discuss this. This is just my take right now. My take might change over time. And yeah, just feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. I'm willing to hear all perspectives on this. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed the interview. Okay, God, that was quite a ramble. Listen, normally I ask here if people want to support the show. Look, there are loads of things you can do. It's on my website. If you go to whatbitcoindid.com/support, it explains what you can do. You can become a patron. You can become a sponsor. You can share the show out. Just have a look there. If you want to support the show, there's a bunch of stuff for you to take a look at there. Okay, so it's a show a day this week. So tomorrow I'm going to be releasing my interview with Daniel Kelman. He's one of the Mt. Gox creditors. While his name might not be one as familiar as Jed McCallum or Mark Coppelis, it's still an interview that's well worth listening to as part of the Mt. Gox story. As I said, if you want to reach out to me, my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I look forward to hearing from you.